You're listening to UK Health Radio. I'm Dr. Dean Mitchell, and this is The Smartest Doctor in the Room, where real medicine meets real answers. Each episode, I bring you honest conversations with some of the brightest minds in health and medicine. Let's get started. Toxic mold exposure in the home is dangerous to your health. I see patients every week in my practice who are suffering from the effects of toxic mold. And in many cases, they were living in a home where they didn't even know mold was present. That's why I recommend to patients who suspect they are ill, possibly from toxic mold exposure, to obtain a test from Immunolytics, a company that specializes in mold detection with simple mold plates for your home or office. The mold plates are put in various rooms of your home and then left open for an hour. They are then closed up and you observe them for 5 days. If the mold plates show growth, you can send them back to Immunolytics and the company will analyze them and interpret the results for you. Please see the link in the show notes to order your mold plates from Immunolytics and use the code SMARTESTDOC to get a 5% discount. Today's podcast is on a specific form of psychotherapy, EMDR, that has proven to be effective, especially for people battling psychological trauma. Now, mental health and psychological counseling has finally started to get the respect it deserves in the medical field. For too many years, it was really, unfortunately, looked down upon seeking out counseling. And honestly, typically in movies and television, there was a lot of like self-mockery about, you know, therapists and, you know, how they interacted with their patients. But as I said, thankfully, that has changed and more people are seeking treatment without shame. For the past several decades also, there's been numerous medications that have come to market to fix depression and anxiety. And while they are definitely effective and helpful, the majority of medical studies still support the fact that psychotherapy in conjunction with medications is not only important, but can enhance a positive outcome. Now, there are many forms of psychotherapy. There's one that a lot of us know about, the classic Freudian psychotherapy, which again is usually depicted in movies with people laying on the couch and the therapist falling asleep behind them. There's also cognitive behavioral therapy, which is more of a practical type where you try to, I believe, change negative thinking, which is really important. But today on the podcast, I'm going to discuss with my guest, Susan Sullivan, who's an expert on EMDR. She's certified in this field. And EMDR stands for Eye Movement Desensitization and Reprocessing. Susan has been a psychiatric and mental health practitioner, and she's got 25 years of experience. She's, as I mentioned, an expert in EMDR and other forms of psychological counseling. And I know from some mutual patients that we've had, she is extremely skilled at her work. So I'm super pleased to welcome Susan Sullivan to the podcast.
Oh, thank you for that introduction, Dean. That was wonderful.
Okay, you deserve it. All right, let's get into it. I like to always touch a little bit on my guest's background because I do think it's important to know where people are coming from. And you mentioned in your bio on your website that you were a critical care nurse at the Nassau County Medical Center, which is a major trauma center here on Long Island. And obviously, as anyone can imagine, that's got to be a high-stress environment. So I was just curious, when and why in your career did you decide to switch from that type of care to what you're doing now?
Yeah, it's a great question, Dean. And it's. I mean, I love my story. I think it's a great story. I did a 2-year associate nursing degree program. So I was a nurse at like 19 years old. So I was very young.
Oh, wow, really young.
Yes, very young. 2 years out of school. And Nassau County Medical Center was my second time going there when I grew up in East Meadow. So I went to East Meadow High
School. Oh, so you're right by. You were in the neighborhood.
So as a senior in high school, I actually did a work study program where we worked as nursing assistants. And where I worked was at Nassau County Medical Center. So a couple days a week, we learned how to be nursing assistants. And then we worked like 20 hours a week. And that's where I was assigned. So I had already been exposed to Nassau County Medical Center as a student in high school. So when I graduated, I got my first job And I was like, I think I want to go back there. So I did. So I worked for a little bit. I worked at Lydia Hull Hospital in Freeport. It was a great little hospital so many years ago. And then I was like, you know what? I think I want to go into trauma. I think I want to go into the ICU. I want to learn all the, the nitty-gritty and the nuts and bolts of critical care. So
You basically threw yourself into the fire. That is not a place for the faint of heart. It's kind of like the
correct.
Bellevue Hospital in New York City of Long Island. You
It
know,
is.
you see everything and
We
anything on a
do.
given day.
We did. And I worked in the surgical trauma unit for, I think it was about 2.5 years. And I saw everything and I did everything. And part of our job there also was to float to all different parts of the hospital. So I floated to the burn unit. I floated to the emergency room. I floated to the inpatient psychiatric unit. We floated everywhere, cover for whatever we needed to cover for. And I got a lot of experience. And I was like, you know what? This is amazing. This is great, but it's very stressful, you know? So at that time, I was like, I think I want to go back to school and I want to get my bachelor's and I want to go back. So I did. I went back for my bachelor's. But all the time that you spend in the ICU with patients, it's intense because it's, they're very.
You can't, right? You can't, one of the things practitioners find, and it's interesting because, again, when I did rotations in my residency in the ICU, for 3 years of internal medicine and in emergency rooms, you think you can, but you can't form this wall where you're not feeling what these patients are experiencing. And I
No.
actually, just one quick thing I wanted to check, because it's really fascinating about your career, which is really different than a lot of therapists and even psychiatrists. I just wonder, it's interesting if you feel like your work in the actual physical part of medicine maybe gave you certain insights that, I mean, even a good psychologist, or a good psychiatrist, because their residencies is obviously not dealing with
No.
physical medicine.
No, I feel like it was really the springboard for me to end up in psychiatry because there was no emotional support service.
Right. Yeah, of course,
So
like fix them up and throw them out,
that's exactly, so that was what we did. So like, when you're working at night and they're, crying because they're paralyzed from the neck down and they're, never going to walk again, like you are their support system. Like when you go to the bedside and you're giving them the medications and they're like, like what happened to me kind of thing, like you're the one, or they've got like a ton of hardware hanging all over them, or
Oh God,
loved
yeah.
ones come in and say like, I don't think I want to give my loved one's organs, I don't know if I want to donate their organs, I know this, I know that, but like all that emotional support, there were no social workers, not like there are now,
And still not the same, because it's kind of a funny thing. I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's like, that's why nurses, I just met one on the street about 2 hours ago. We were online somewhere and we were talking, and people don't appreciate how difficult that job is and how important it is, because obviously, especially in hospitals when people are at their most vulnerable, the nurses are the ones that probably are spending the most amount of time at the bedside. And that's where people want to really feel that connection. Unfortunately, the way the system has worked, the doctors are in and out and on to the next thing, but the nurses are the one who remain on the floor in the ICU, being there, and not just to hand out medications or start an IV.
Yeah, we were it, so we were it. So it just was very intuitive to me and very natural for me to want to help them emotionally, but like I had no idea that there was advanced practice nurse practitioners, that there was this other.
Right. That was all kind of,
I
newer
had no
stuff.
idea. I was just doing, just being me and doing my thing. And then when I went back to school to be, an RN with a bachelor's degree, like I learned different things and I went into administration and I did some other things. And I was like, you know what? I don't really like a lot of this stuff. Let me go back to the clinical stuff. But originally, I was in the adult nurse practitioner program at Stony Brook when I started. And then one of my best friends at the time, she was in the psych mental health track.
Hi everyone. I know you may already know from listening to my podcast that I specialize in treating patients with toxic mold exposure. It's become a serious problem for many years as we deal with the hurricanes and floods throughout the country. Even simple bathroom water leaks from a toilet in your home over time can contribute to mold buildup. I can help patients that suffer from the symptoms of toxic mold, but I also rely on the patients getting their current residence inspected so they are not continually being exposed. My go-to person for mold exposure is Joe Reese. Joe is a certified mold inspector
with decades of experience. He is super thorough and gives you a straightforward assessment and tells you whether it's safe to live in your home or if there is mold. I should know, I used Joe when I moved to my new home 4 years ago. Fortunately, when I moved in, I smelled the unusual odor in my basement and I immediately called Joe. He came over with his instruments and he found the problem. Afterwards, I had remediation and the problem was solved. Joe does inspections all throughout the country. He welcomes calls to his cell phone at 908-451-4592. You can also reach him by email at jprconsultants7929@gmail.com. Remember, mold in your home is not a good thing, but thankfully it's a problem that can be fixed.
And she was like, let's take this family theory systems class together. And I was like, okay, I'll do it. And the professor just like, I got hooked.
Turned you on. Yeah. How many years were you an ICU like nurse? I'm just curious.
I worked in ICU for a long time. Cause I worked for an agency when I went back for my bachelor's degree. So from like 1983 to 19, so it was probably like 5 or 6 years.
Well, that's something that's a reasonably good amount of time.
Critical care area. It was great when I worked for an agency because I would just work on weekends or days off that I didn't have to. And I would just go to all these different hospitals on Long Island because there was such a nursing shortage for critical
care. Yeah, we've always dealt with that at some point in time.
So I would work in ERs, ICUs, recovery rooms, like wherever they needed me, I worked. And those experiences taught me like I could be a nurse anywhere in the world. I can do anything I want because you're seeing, you know.
Sure. You get it, all the experience.
All the experience that you need and all the ways different hospitals run and all the different people in it. So it was for me, like you asked me that question, like, do you feel like all that experience has made you a different psych NP? I think it's made me a much better psych NP.
I would think so. I have one thing I want to ask you too, because from what I know, and again, it's probably pretty little, you know, it seems like when I've talked to different therapists, you know, and like when I'm dealing with patients, you know, sometimes we get into some, you know, training or personal things that a lot of the, I guess, the programs, typically the psychologist or psychiatrist has to go through therapy themselves. And we're going to get to in just a few minutes, because I know a lot of the listeners want to hear about the EMDR. Was that required for you to undergo therapy before you became a therapist?
It was required. We had to be in group therapy. So as peers, we had a group therapist so that we would have support, but also that we could then kind of like bounce ideas off of each other.
And practice on each other?
Yeah. No, back then there wasn't a whole lot of therapy to practice on each other, you know, so it was very Freudian, you know, and that didn't resonate with me.
Like, okay.
It was more of a, you know, attachment-based type of practitioner, but I did really do the family systems was what I really started out with. But yes, we had to be in individual therapy for ourselves. And it was so funny because like I was young, I was, you know, in my 20s, and I'm like, there's nothing wrong with me. I don't really need therapy.
Right.
I have to go. And wow, it was just a life-changing experience for me because I learned so much about myself and I just realized. And she was a family systems theory therapist. And she just taught me about how to assess somebody, how to treat somebody, but then how that was impacting
how they felt. You know, that's so unique about psychiatry and psychology. I have to say this. I want to just like really emphasize this to the listeners because, you know, again, I love the Bernie Siegel line. Dr. Bernie Siegel, the famous author and Yale surgeon, he used to say, you know, the doctors are the tourists, the patients are the native of the land because they live it. And what's really interesting, I'll never forget once, so I remember reading this, there was one of the medical schools, I think it was at UCLA or whatever, and they had the first year medical students. And what they did, this was so quite unique and important, like right at the beginning of their careers, take them on the hospital ward, put away their white coats, had them put on patient gowns and go into rooms, and they each assigned them a diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And then these other residents or doctors would come in and examine them. And, you know, just for our listeners, you say, well, what the heck is that about? Well, you know, like any of us, when we were all on that other side of the table and you're the patient, boy, does it feel different. And boy, do you kind of understand what your needs are? Not just, of course, you want to get better, but how you're treated. You know, am mm-hmm. I correct? And that's why I think, I mean, obviously in medicine, it's hard. You can't have somebody else's disease. But that kind of training is critically, I think, important to be, is it empathetic is the right word, I guess?
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
I think it's really, really important. I think it brought to light the fact that, like, I felt the same way that so many other people feel. Like, I didn't think there was anything wrong with me, right?
Yeah.
Like, I didn't think I could benefit from therapy. I didn't think it would be helpful. And it was life-changing, and it was really amazing. And to be, you know, a patient and to come in feeling uncomfortable, or to, you know, have to cancel a session and be like, oh my God, what does she think about me if I cancel the session? And, you know, and then even just finishing with her, like when I finished my program, like I was like, can I continue therapy? She was like, yeah. And then we reevaluated my goals. And she was like, I think you're fine. And then she ended up being my consultant and helped me get
interesting. Yeah, I want to get into that too, because one of the things that you do are so unique is that it's not a long protracted treatment, which is a little bit unusual for therapy. So I'd like to get into, because I think the listeners are probably really key on this. You know, before I had heard about you, I had heard a little bit, I must have read in maybe a New York Times Science article once or something about EMDR, which I really knew very little about. I just knew it had something to do with eye movements. And it made a little bit of sense, again, but I knew a very surface amount of information. So can you just, for us to get started, before we get a little more deeper, maybe explain to the listeners what EMDR is, you know, and again, who would maybe be a good candidate for it, you know, versus, because other people may have been going to therapy for years and gotten stuck or it didn't work for them. So
yes, those are good patients for actually EMDR therapy. So yeah, EMDR therapy is a type of trauma therapy. And Francine Shapiro really bases the therapy on the adaptive information processing. So it's, you know, it's based on like your neurological information system in your body is intrinsic. It's physical, it's adaptive, right? It's geared to be integrated and for internal and external experiences, right? And so then all these experiences are stored in these associative memory networks, right? And so that's where we get, that's the basis for our perception, for our behaviors, for our attitudes. And so then we look at those experiences and then they're like translated into physically linked memories, right? So she believed that the stored memories, experiences, they contribute to our pathology, right? And our health. So like if we have all these really good memory networks, then like we'll probably perceive something or look at something different, right? And, you know, her way of looking at it is that, you know, our body wants to heal. Our body wants to go towards healing. So if we give it what it needs, then it will go towards healing, right? So it's actually, you know, pretty interesting. And she's done some, you know, she's got a whole bunch of evidence-based research on her, on the website, right, on the EMDR website. So it's kind of nice to see that it is an evidence-based model. And there are a lot of randomized controlled studies, and there are a lot of different people doing research all the time for EMDR therapy. So that's what I kind of like about it is that, as a nurse, we are very science-based, very research-based. And so we like to look at that theoretical model through that lens. I do.
So, what is a typical session like? And what I mean is that, again, going from TV and movies, you people picture the typical Freudian, maybe
Yeah.
cognitive therapy, laying on the couch, sitting there,
It's so funny.
philosophizing about your and the therapist is like saying, "Oh, okay, what happened in your childhood?" I'm making a little fun, but that
Yes.
idea. I mean, there are other ones that are more like laid back or serious in the sense that you just sit in a chair and you discuss. Obviously, maybe some recent things that really bother you. I mean, there's a lot of things that people, it's just very healthy to get it off their chest.
Yes.
But I don't know, with EMDR, do you go for walks with people? Or, I mean,
I
what's
do.
your, really typically, if a patient came to you and or was referred or found out what you're doing? Because again, you even told me before we did this podcast that, which was really striking to me, is that, again, you usually do this in a few sessions. It's not an ongoing relationship. And that's one of the things too. I'm sorry just to mention again that, sometimes I think there is a little concern that, and I don't like to have this in my own practice, where patients become, quote, like addicted or dependent on the practitioner, which is never a great thing.
Right. So what I did in my career, because I used to prescribe and I did medication management and psychotherapy together. So it was really a lovely combination. And I really saw the benefits of what you said in the beginning, like, meds and therapy together is where patients can get, one of their best outcomes. But I found that doing weekly therapy with patients, 45 minutes or an hour, it was okay. It was good. But I was finding that, like, if we wanted to get into something deep or if we wanted to do something that was really big, that most of the time that was not enough time. So I started doing some research and I started doing some things. And then I was like, you know what? I think I want to pivot my career in a different way. So I stopped prescribing and I kind of closed down a big part of my practice where I had about 150 patients in my practice. I had a pretty big practice for a single practitioner. And I kind of used the patients that I was doing meds and therapy with and asked them if they would try this longer model, if they would be interested in doing some different things with me. So I had been learning more stuff about attachment repair. I had been doing more parts work. I had been doing polyvagal theory, some somatic work, learning more about dissociation and some different things. So I was like, you know what? I want to put all this together and see if I can move these patients in a different way. And so that's kind of how it evolved. And then I started looking and asking around in the EMDR community, like who was doing longer sessions, and people were calling it EMDR intensive. So based on that, I kind of put this model together for myself. So like a typical patient, I'll assess them and based on what their goal is, what their need is, then I kind of say to them about how many sessions I'd like to do with them. And I only work up to 3 hours. So my maximum is 3 hours. I feel like the brain kind of gets
Yeah, that's kind of hard.
tired.
I can't sit through anything for more than 2 hours.
Right, exactly. So
Unless it's a giant football game and they're winning.
Between 2 and 3 hours is kind of the sweet spot. So, but what I tell patients is like, depending, like, so say your goal is like you had a car accident and you want to clear whatever trauma is involved in a car accident. I would call that like a single event, right? So it's
Yeah.
probably like 2 days. We do 1 day of a little bit of prep work and probably reprocess it on the second day. And then you come back for a re-evaluation in a couple of weeks. And those are usually probably like cleaner and easier, but those are not typically the patients that I see.
I didn't think so. I mean, I would think that you're seeing the people that have had some kind of major trauma, whether it was military experience,
Correct.
what's the child abuse, parental abuse, that stuff is deep. It leaves a deep wound.
Yes.
I have to just mention something for a second because I think it will dovetail into what we've been talking about. I talked about this once on a podcast in the past with a doctor who was very interesting, Dr. Samuel Mann, and he was the hypertension specialist in New York. And this is an interesting case, I think, that you'll see applies to what you kind of work you do. He worked at Cornell for many years. He recently retired. He just started his own podcast, actually. And we had this case together. I did not know him at the time, but I had a patient that came in, a young man in his 30s. And he came in because he was having asthma. And that was one of the things I was specializing back in the day at that time. And I was evaluating for allergies and stuff. But I checked his blood pressure, obviously, and when I was doing my physical exam, and his blood pressure was like 200 over 120. And then my jaw dropped. I was like, wow, do you know that you have a blood pressure? I mean, he seemed perfectly fine. And he goes, yeah, I've been told it's a little high sometimes. So I said, okay, we finished our exam. I said, please wait in the waiting room. I didn't want to send him to the hospital because I didn't think he was in that kind of danger, although it was a very high blood pressure. So I immediately called up Cornell, which has like a well-known hypertension clinic. And I didn't know anybody over there, but I referred him over there. And about 2 weeks later, I get a call from Dr. Mann, who had seen him. And he said, you know, thank you for the referral. It's a little bit unusual. Most of the time, doctors don't call you to follow up on that. So, but I was pleased. You know, he's a very nice man. And we got into a little bit of a conversation. We were both very mind-body medicine, which was a nice connection. We both actually believed a lot in somebody called Dr. Sarno's work on back pain, which is very interesting. But this was the real kicker in this case. He said to me, you know, that young man with that super high blood pressure, he said, I don't know if you know this, and I guess Dr. Mann got into this. He said when he was a child, he saw his mother killed in front of him. Yeah. And th this is the interesting part I wanted to ask you. It's going to go into why I'm bringing this story up now. So you could tell this guy was the type of person was like very stoic and I guess whatever, a compensator. And Dr. Mann says to me something very interesting. He says, I'll give him some blood pressure medicine because that's not going to fix the problem. He goes, there's something else deeper here.
If you've been following the podcast, you may know I practice holistic functional medicine and immunology. In fact, at Mitchell Medical Group, we've been treating chronic fatigue patients for 3 decades. It's critical in this work to have a trusted pharmacy that can compound medications for our sensitive patients' needs. ITC Pharmacy has been our go-to pharmacy the entire time. They can make medications ranging from thyroid hormones to dye-free medications for all of our highly sensitive, even allergic patients. If you or your holistic doctor are looking for these very specific patient medications, you can contact ITC at 888-349-5453. They have licenses throughout the country and can have medications delivered right to your doorsteps. My patients have been so pleased with their service, and you will be too.
He has to be very careful to whatever therapist he goes to because he's built so many protective layers that if somebody just tries to unleash this, that could be more catastrophic. So that was my long-winded question to you. The kind of work you're doing, if it's with child abuse, parental abuse, you know, some horrible thing that's happened to someone's life, in this even intensive environment, I could see the benefit of getting to the problems, like getting, you know, putting your finger on the issue, but how do you do it so it doesn't cause more damage than the benefit?
Right, that's a really great question. So, like, we kind of have to look at and we think about. So, like, when we think about EMDR, it's like an 8-phase model. And so, the second phase of that, like, the first phase is history taking and treatment planning, and then the second phase is more like a preparation phase. So, for somebody like that, like, we look for their strengths, we look for things about them that like they've mastered, or that they maybe have spiritual connections or relational things that are, helpful to them, and ways that they've coped that have been positive coping mechanisms. And we try to like enhance that again, thinking about the adaptive information processing, those memory networks, we try to grow them bigger. I do a lot of parts work with patients, Dean. So somebody like him, I would do a lot of parts work with and kind of do a lot of psychoeducation in regards to that protective part, right? That protective part has done an amazing job in keeping him alive and keeping him safe and doing all the things that he needed to do to get through the day, right?
Right.
Then you have to assess for dissociation, right? He's the kind of person that probably needs a lot of attachment work too, because his mom was killed in front of him. So there's obviously some kind of violence there, right? Something happened somewhere. So a lot of screens and a lot of like attachment interview questions. And kind of, I do, because I'm a family systems theory therapist, I do a genogram on everybody. So I get like a really good sense of generational trauma, where they're at, how they were raised, what's happened to them. So based on all that information, I would then put a plan together to say, like, you know what? He probably needs me to do X, Y, and Z before we actually reprocess the trauma of him, losing his mom and witnessing
But
it.
you have to, let me ask you, I'm just fascinated by this. Sometimes you see this like in movies or something. Is it almost like too, I guess at some point you could have him almost visualize being back in the situation, but being an adult and maybe be able to protect his mom or something. And or
What I would
something where you're giving, because again, as a little boy, you're helpless. And that probably that fear and anger at yourself for being helpless.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
It's got to be traumatic. Yet, if you somehow were able to work the mind and the spirit to say, look, you were a little boy, but if you had been an adult, you could have maybe done something. Would that be potentially beneficial?
It's so interesting that you say that, Dean, because exactly what I do with patients is I call it a parts retrieval. So what I do with many patients, and it's people tell me it feels amazing to them. However old he was when his mom killed himself, this particular person, say he's 11. So I would, do the parts work with him, different parts. And then I'd ask if he could bring that 11-year-old into the room, right? And so we kind of magically bring him into the room, and then we give him a whole, exactly what you said, a whole developmental update, right? So however old the person is, say they're like 25 when they come to see me, right? And they're 11. So we're going to give them a 14-year-old update. We're going to, tell them we're driving, we're an adult, we're this, we're that, we're doing all these different things. Like we've gone to college, we have a job, we have all
Right, it
this.
became a person. I mean, this person became a person.
Correct. But
I
then
mean,
we
I think he
feed
did that with
them.
his daughter, which is really amazing. I'll never forget it. I mean, I guess like those things like that you never forget. Like I remember because he was like work. I guess his wife was doing something. He came in during the middle of the day or in the afternoon, and he had like a 6-year-old daughter waiting in the waiting room, and like this whole thing was evolving. I was like.
And so then we give them that, but then we also give them that nurturing piece that they didn't get at the time. So a lot of times when we talk about trauma, Dean, we talk about like it's not so much what happened, it's what didn't happen, right? And what didn't happen afterwards or never happened, right? So it's like we give them all that information that they never gave. So I have them all fill out like it's like an imaginal nurturing, a list of adjectives and different things that they might want their younger part to hear. And so then based on those things, because then it kind of personalizes, like he wants to say he's lovable, he wants to say that he was funny or creative or whatever. But like I want him to know, I want that younger part to know that he's safe, that it's over, that he's important, that he's valued, right? And then we try to see where that goes. And depending on their parts and how, like if they have structural dissociation, it might be a little bit harder to integrate it. But where are we integrating these parts? And then the goal is to bring that part into the heart, into the self, integrate that younger part into themselves before we even reprocess the memory. So what it does is it kind of shakes up the memory because we remove that younger person from whatever the memory is. Like, so say he's at his house when this all happened, we remove him from his house, bring him here, and then we kind of check in with him, make sure that he's safe, make sure that he's okay. And then we can go in and sometimes reprocess the memory differently, right? So I'm always looking for patients like, External figures that could be nurturing figures, internal experiences that can be nurturing experiences, because we all need that, right? As mammals, we must get our
Yes. You're saying something so important. I just want the listeners to understand too. You know, again, one of the things that is sometimes depicted on TV, but it's also in real life. You know, unfortunately, in the psychiatry field too, a lot of unusual personalities seem to be attracted to that area. And, you know, one of the things I read, again, I'm not an expert by any means, but I remember reading once about Carl Rogers, who's a very famous, I think, psychologist. Not, I don't think he was a psychiatrist, but, you know, one of his things was like the things that he emphasized was like full support of the patient, meaning like he would, I think he did demonstrations sometimes. He would bring a patient up on a stage. I remember hearing about this, and he would just sit with them. And I guess he was so amazing at what he did. Like the first few minutes, he would just sit there and look intently at the person. And that person would feel that sort of that love, which is incredible. And then whatever else he did was he was just so reaffirming to them. You know, because I guess so many times too, again, you see things, or I guess it depends how therapists are trained. They're like, oh no, you know, you did this all wrong, or you got to break up with this guy, and you know, all these things. And I thought his approach was so important, because I know in my own practice, and you know, it's a functional medicine, holistic immunology practice, but I do feel like one of my main jobs, you know, the part of me that is like a therapist, is that giving people reasonable hope, being their support, you know, not being the one saying, oh, you're never going to get better, or I mean, I know it sounds crazy, but I hear this too often. People are dismissed and, you know, not given that. And I try the best that I can. But, and I want to ask you this, because this is so important. You mentioned it again from your website. I found this very interesting. And you mentioned you do something called ego state work. And you said, I thought, like, I'm quoting you here, but I thought this was so important. One of the biggest reasons, you know, that I guess the patients feel they don't achieve their goals because they have these unresolved conflicts within themselves. And you know, I see a lot of young patients in my practice, many of them in their 20s and 30s, and I really feel for them. I mean, it is, I don't care what people say, probably one of the most anxiety-provoking times in your life. You're sort of like on your way, but you're not there yet. Are you going to make it? And they're usually the hardest, you know, persons on themselves. So again, this kind of EMDR and work that you do, is this the right thing for someone who's struggling?
Yeah, like the ego state work is the parts work. So like it's really looking at all of that piece. But you know, like I tell people all the time, like EMDR as a standalone is a great therapy, right? It works for a lot of things, but when you have complex PTSD, you need more than just the standard EMDR protocol. You need other tools, you need other resources, you need other things. So my toolbox over the years has gotten very, very big. You know, like I've taught myself all different kinds of things. Like, you know, you're a life learner, I'm a life learner. You know, it's just like you just keep learning as you go. And so,
Yes.
like, I love, you know, I love somatic stuff. I love all that felt sense stuff. I'm a very somatic
Okay.
practitioner. And I feel like that really kind of helps, you know, clear the body of the trauma when we look at like where are you feeling it in your body and what does that look like? What does that feel like? And, you know, how can we kind of move you energetically through that? And then the polyvagal theory is something that I find from a psychoeducation place is just really super easy for people to understand. Like there's this nerve, this vagus nerve that runs up
Yeah,
and
that's a big thing. I've actually I've interviewed on my podcast Kevin Tracy, who discovered the importance of the vagus nerve. And again, just for our listeners, what Susan's referring to is there's a Stephen Porges, a very well-known psychologist, who's done a lot of research on, you know, this vagus nerve. It's the cranial nerve number 10, which goes all throughout your body. That you know, when it's just, you know, it's disturbed. That, you know, the same, that nerve goes to your stomach and give you acid reflux. When it goes to your lungs, I mean, it can cause asthma. I was just writing an article about a woman I saw in the emergency room when I was back in my residency days. Like 2 Saturday nights in a row, came in what we call status asthmaticus, where she couldn't even breathe. And like we were shocked, like, what happened? 2 weeks in a row, was it a bad infection or whatever? No. Saturday nights was the night her husband got drunk and they had a big fight, and she would, I guess, her self-defense was getting a severe asthma attack. So these things, like as you're saying, you know, somatic, you know, the brain and the rest of the body are in very close communication.
Yes, the body knows before the brain, right? The
Yeah.
body knows before the brain. So I teach a lot of that. Like, we use a term called window of presence, and then like sympathetic nervous system, parasympathetic nervous system. So I give like a lot of little like handouts and different things to understand like what's happening in your body when you're activated. Why is your stomach like got butterflies or tightness or tension, the sympathetic nervous system, like what does that look like? And then like the shutdown, dissociation, like Stephen Porges talks about it, right? It's part of the nervous system's protective mechanism. It's part of the survival mechanism. So we normalize all of that because many people who grew up in homes that weren't safe have this part of them that is always a little bit disconnected from reality.
I'd like to take a moment to let my listeners know that my new book, Conquering Candida, is now available on Amazon in paperback and ebook. If you believe you suffer from Candida, this is the first book in 50 years since the original book, The Yeast Connection by Dr. William Crook, to give credence to this underdiagnosed and undertreated condition. If you also want to understand gut health and the microbiome, I also believe you will enjoy this book. I do appreciate if you read this book to rate it on Amazon and provide your comments and a review.
So what is the actual, and I want to ask you about this because I actually had somebody who I had heard about the tapping. When people do the tapping, I'm not really, I really don't know a lot about it, but what is it about the eye movements? And also, is it sort of the part that, you know, because I tell my patients a lot of times too, like when I'm working with them, I said, this is a partnership. I can't do all the work. I'm not going to cure you that way. Like in my case, I have to have them follow a diet, take certain supplements. Now,
Right.
you teach them obviously with this EMDR certain eye movements, and then do they have to practice this at home, or is that like a resource? How does that work?
So for EMDR that we use bilateral stimulation, so there, but it's alternating, it can be any type of bilateral stimulation. So I'll usually do different types of bilateral stimulation with patients to see which one kind of resonates with
Okay.
them. We have like I have a headset that I put on, and then we call them binaural beats. So it's alternating beats in the ears. It goes bump, 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 bump. And we can make it faster or slower depending on what we need, and louder or softer depending on, you know, how loud they need it to be. And then there's also eye movements where you kind of move your finger or you move a
Well,
pen.
so you have to do it with them, or do they? But they take that at home and do that as well.
I actually do everything with my
So
patients.
they don't do this at home on their own.
They no, I wouldn't
No,
recommend
because it really
doing
needs
it
to
on
be
their own.
directed and guided.
Correct, correct. And if you're doing virtual with someone, then they do have these like platforms where you can pull up like a little, it looks like actually like a little ball, and the ball goes back and forth on your computer for eye movements. But I just use my fingers, and so like I make sure I go to the gym and my arms, you know, stays healthy. But we also have like it's like called a light bar, where like the light goes back and forth. So a lot of people use that for the eye movement to go back and forth. And then there's tapping. You can tap yourself. I'll have patients tap themselves sometimes, but I most of the time, if I tap, I tap on them, right? And so there's
I'm
all.
sorry, is the and this EMDR and the tapping, is that to sort of like regulate what we call the limbic part of the brain and the
So
vagal
it's to
nervous
reduce
system?
the intensity of the traumatic memories, right? So
No.
right. It just promotes integration between emotional and cognitive
Okay.
function.
Okay. Have you
So
ever used, you know, it's become very popular and I'm learning more and more about it, like the vagal nerve stimulators like Palo Neuro, you know, the wristbands or the gamma cord. Do you ever find that's helpful with patients or?
I had somebody just ask me that recently, and I said I didn't know a lot about it, but
Okay.
I think it's something for certain people to look at. I give patients vagal toning exercises to help them, like humming and singing and
Right.
breathing, right? And also, there's a Stanley Rosenberg has a great book, and
Oh, yes, that's right. I've heard of his
yeah,
exercises, right.
he has a whole bunch of exercises based on Stephen Porges. Theory, polyvagal theory. And so I'll teach them the basic exercise, the Salomon
Oh, really? That's very
exercise.
interesting. I've heard from somebody else I've worked with, Dr. Nathan, California. He's a big fan of that because, you know, one of the things that in my specialty with what's called mast cell activation and everything, we're really finding that, again, there's this very intricate mind-body connection and
Absolutely.
that all these people that are getting like all these, well, quote, multiple chemical sensitivities and all these things related to mast cells with their heart rate going off, that you know, they become so complicated that we have to calm down the limbic and vagal nervous system. And just one of the things I have to throw in there, you know, one of the people I've interviewed, I think twice on the podcast, really interesting, Dr. Dave Rabin. He's a psychiatrist, a medical doctor. He worked for many years at the Pittsburgh VA. And he was the one that it was really interesting. He did the research showing the device, which now is his Apollo Neuro device, by regulating the vagal nervous system. He was working with a lot of the vets who came back with PTSD from the wars and exposures, and was finding that it was helping. So,
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So I'll do that. And I'm also a yoga teacher. So
oh, interesting.
yeah, so and yoga is, oh my gosh, so great for the vagus
It
nerve,
is, yeah.
so great for the nervous system. So we'll do some chair yoga, we'll do some breathing. I just did alternate nostril breathing with a
Oh,
patient.
I like doing that too. Again,
Yeah.
I'm like you. I picked up all these things from colleagues that, a lot of times I would either go to them as a patient because I wanted to go through it myself. We became friends. And again, what you said before is so important. I tell this to the medical students all the time. I tell them the quick story. I said, when I was finishing medical school, I was so tired of studying. I was so tired of taking tests. I said, I'm never opening a book again. I'll just learn whatever I learn. And lo and behold, a couple of years into training, I'm like, oh, wow, that's interesting. I gotta learn more about that. So you keep on reading more and more journals. And then, you get into private practice and it can get too rote or boring if you do the same thing. So I've always found to energize myself when I hear somebody doing something interesting, I say, well, maybe that could help me in my practice. And like you need a lot of tools in your toolbox. I tell the medical students, I said, one of the reasons why you have to keep learning is because real medicine is not like medical school where you take a test and there's A, B, C, and D, and there's always a right answer. Because, in real life, there ain't always a real answer. You gotta find the best solution.
And one size doesn't fit all, because
Of
people will say to
course,
me,
right?
how come it's taking me longer than someone else, or how come this is happening?
Right,
And I'm
right.
just like, it's just what your nervous system will allow. It's what your brain and body will allow you
Yeah,
to do. Like
those are the
if
hardest
those,
things.
yeah, if those protective mechanisms are really big, then we have to slowly develop trust, and we slowly have to develop safety, and we need, you need to know what that is. You need to be able to figure that out. So yeah, I love essential oils. I use them all the
Oh,
time.
really? Yeah, it's true. People don't realize how I go to somebody who's a massage therapist, Marjorie Brooke. I've had her on the podcast. And this is kind of interesting too. Whenever I go there, I like to do some stretching or training because she's terrific. She knows I like this. It's like this Indian music, American Indian music. And in the beginning, I didn't really notice it, but then I started realizing, like, I feel very comfortable when I'm there. And she's a very big believer in sound energy, it's unfortunate when people go to a regular doctor's office right away, it's like this cold, sterile environment. I mean, how are you going to start healing when you feel like you have to, gird your loins,
Well, my office is my healing space. So people will come in and they're like, oh
Yeah.
my gosh, this is so beautiful. I love it. I
Yes.
feel so comfortable. And so that's all part of the healing process, is that they feel comfortable in the office, and they feel like
No,
it's
that's great.
an okay place for them
You feel
to
safe.
start to unravel some of this
Yeah.
stuff. So yeah. But what I love about essential oils, to just swing back, is that they go directly to the amygdala. So when you
Yes,
sniff,
yes. Yeah, the nose is a good place.
yes, a nose. So I give somebody frankincense and they're like, boom.
That smells really good. You're right. I've sometimes burned some incense with that. I never thought I'd be doing this kind of thing, but as I said, I've worked with some people and I'm like, hey, anything that can help. Because even also as practitioners, we seem to also feel or carry the weight of our patients. At the end of the week, I really feel it. Susan, I'm sorry, we're gonna start to finish up. Is there any one last thing we didn't cover you'd like to mention?
No, I think
We covered a lot of ground. Okay,
you
so
covered a
before we
lot of
finish,
ground.
how could patients who are interested in this therapy contact you or find out about your work? What's the best place?
Best place is probably my website. So it's Susan Sullivan Therapy. So that's one place. And they can also look at the EMDRIA website. It's EMDRIA. So it's the International Association. So it's EMDR International Association. They can go there and they can look for therapists. If they're looking specifically for like EMDR intensives, they can kind of type that in. But if they're like out of the state, out of New York State, and they're looking for resources in other places, like we have like, we have Facebook pages, we have listservs, we have all different resources that people can kind of connect therapists with other therapists if there's not someone in the area. But probably my website is the best place to look up, like you did, look up, see what I look like, see what my bio says and that kind of stuff. And if they're interested, and if they're interested in like any type of therapist, I tell them all the time, look for someone who's minimally certified. Right. So I think that's important, that at least they've gotten advanced training from the basic training, right? So we get
Yeah.
consultation hours in the basic training, but then we get longer hours towards certification. And then, maybe someone who's a consultant, if there's a consultant in the area, usually facilitators and trainers, they're like even more advanced, so like I
Well, I think you have a really unique set of skill sets. I've got you're in Huntington?
I'm in Huntington,
Huntington,
correct.
Long Island. Okay, so any of our listeners, I don't want to bombard Susan, but if you need help, I think she's be an amazing resource.
Yeah.
So
And if it's not a good fit for me time-wise or, whatever, then, just reach out and I'm happy to see if I can find some resources for them. Because I think that's the hardest part is like
yeah, it is. It's guiding them through this very difficult maze, and especially in this area where there is a lot of not always the lot most clarity. So anyway, thank you so much, Susan. This was terrific. We'll do
You're
this again and we'll be in
welcome.
touch.
Sure. Great.
Okay, enjoy your weekend and your Thanksgiving.
Thank you. You too. Take care,
All right.
Dean.
Well, I'll shoot you an email when it's going to be aired in a couple of weeks.
Perfect.
All
Okay.
right, take care. Thanks for joining me here on UK Health Radio. I'm Dr. Dean Mitchell. If today's conversation was useful to you, please share it with someone who could benefit. You can find every episode of The Smartest Doctor in the Room wherever you listen to podcasts. Until next time, stay well.